You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod. Hey everyone, we had a slight issue with the audio on one end of our recording today, so there may be a couple of moments where the audio jumps up and down just a little bit, but don't worry, nothing's the matter, and it's a great show. Hope you enjoy.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again, and as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is Justine D'Souza, but first, I just want to tell you all what's keeping me going this week, which is the numerous interviews that Johnny Weir and Tara Lipinski have been giving together, particularly the one today for GQ, talking about the 13 suitcases each that they've been bringing for their many, many costume changes. There are a few things in life that I enjoy more than reading interviews with weirdly best friends who met at like a strange time in their lives and have sort of arranged their entire lives around one another and are willing to sort of say anything in an interview format because they both bring out the most like vivacious in one another and neither of them has a good sense of editing each other. What I'm trying to say is these two remind me of my relationship with Nicole Cliff, and this is exactly the sort of interview I hope that the two of us can give in 20 years. Not because we're 20 years younger than the two of them, but because it's going to take at least 20 years for me to get 13 suitcases, because right now I only have one and that's a long ways to go. So give me time and soon I will be as glamorous as Johnny Weir. And then my advice will be all the better. All right, this week in the studio, we have Justine D'Souza, who works in social media for a nonprofit and is a phone support counselor for a youth helpline. She also enjoys performing in operas, musicals, and plays. And the reason she's our guest today is because a while back, she emailed me and asked to be on the show. And I said, why not? And now she's here. Hey, Justine, welcome.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so excited that you could join us. Thank you again so much for saying something, because that's often my favorite way to get somebody on the show is just hearing from somebody who feels like giving the world advice.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Well, I'm excited that you're here. I'm excited that you're willing to do your best. And let's just dive right in. I'm going to go ahead and read our very first letter. The subject is just got my health back, which is great, right? Like, what a beautiful start. Someone has gotten their health back. It's already like off to a better start than many other podcasts we have done in the past. Dear Prudence, I'm a 48-year-old woman. After many years of unemployment due to ill health, I'm finally back in the workforce. While I'm now doing better and able to work, I do have a chronic disease called essential thrombocythemia, which can cause either blood clots or uncontrolled bleeding if I get bruised. It's a rare disease, but it's also manageable. I take my medication and it's under control. My problem is that I have no idea how or when to bring this up, or even if I should. I am required to see my hematologist once a month for blood work. I'm mostly doing office work, and most places would frown on me for having to take off several hours. My hematologist is always running late, once a month. There's also the issue of possible iron infusions, where I would need to take off at least half a day from work. How do I bring this up to potential employers? When I was working full-time, I rarely took time off, so I'm not sure what to do now. Wouldn't this turn off an interviewer knowing their group insurance rates could go up if they hired a person like me? Oh, letter writer, you wonderful person. I am so glad you wrote into us because there is a very important set of protections in place for exactly this such thing. And it's called the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it is specifically designed to prevent employers from making hiring decisions based on somebody else's health status, whether actual or perceived. So, you know, I don't want to say, don't worry, you're never going to run into any problems as a result of this. But if an employer refused to hire you out of fear that your pre-existing health condition would raise their group insurance rates, they would be in a lot of trouble. They're not allowed to do that. So I guess just number one, that's good news that we have the ADA. Like, that's just a nice way to start off, I think. Justine, what do you feel about it? It sounds like this person does not actually have a job yet, even though they have said they're back in the workforce. It kind of sounds more like they're either temping or hoping to get hired soon. Was that your read on it too?
Yeah, that's what it sounded like, or at least that they're in the physical state that they're able to work now and that it's a possibility. So I definitely want to back up what you said that in the interview stage, they definitely should not have to disclose their disability status. This is a very American problem, I find, having lived abroad, not being used to taking time off and putting the needs of the company and the job sometimes above one's own health in terms of thinking about this. But, you know, it sounds like once this person gets an offer, it would be good to, and once everything's signed off, to disclose their needs. And they might be surprised at how flexible certain places can be, because once a month is actually not a lot of time. And, you know, if they're able to fulfill their responsibilities, it shouldn't be an issue with the other timelines.
Right. I think that's an important caveat to put in place, which is two things. One of which I think that the ADA does not always apply to companies with fewer than 15 employees. So if this letter writer was applying to very, very small companies, she might not have the exact same legal protections. Although, again, what she's describing sounds pretty minimal. And then the other thing worth bearing in mind has left my head entirely. What was I going to say? This is terrible. This has never happened to me before on the air. The other thing is that an employer, you know, as long as you could fulfill the job requirements, you know, there's no reason for your health issues to come up. There's nothing about your condition that would make it impossible or even especially difficult for you to do office work. So I think you can definitely relax a little bit in terms of having to disclose. I think you think this might be worse than it really is. If you apply for a job, you know, do your best in the interview, don't mention your health in any sense. And then once you get the job, if you say, you know, by the way, once a month I have a doctor's appointment, I think the odds are excellent that most workplaces would say, great, thank you for letting us know. We will work around that.
Also, maybe when she's negotiating her benefits, she could think of flex time and different work schedules and things like that that might make it easier for her to work around the appointment she needs.
Right. And just, I think, letter writer, you know, when you say, how would I potentially bring this up with potential employers, wait until after you've been hired. Don't think of this as something that you need to apologize for. You are a human being, and human beings have health concerns that they have to manage. We are not just, you know, robots who only perform work and then turn off at the end of the day. Nothing you're describing is especially time consuming. Possible iron infusions for half a day, but it doesn't sound like you've experienced any of those yet. So again, that's not something that's on the immediate horizon. Just focus on getting a job, interviewing as best you can. And then once you have been hired, you know, only in as much as your boss would need to know. Like, you don't need to disclose, I have this disease. Although, you know, again, look into your state's like labor department, find out a little bit more about the ADA protections that you might qualify for. But you don't have to disclose your condition. You can simply say, I have a doctor's appointment once a month. And as long as that's not directly affecting your work, you don't have to go into a ton of detail. If you're super comfortable with your boss and you want to say, like, by the way, it's for this blood thing that I'm managing, you can, but you're not obligated to share that information.
Yeah, I would also like it if the letter writer could be a little bit kinder to themselves, because, you know, it's great that you're back in the workforce, as Mallory said, and that you're looking to take care of your needs. And that should definitely be the focus. Of course, these are legitimate questions to ask about a future job. But, you know, just remember that your own health is priority, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that kind of like, I never used to take time off and I'm not really sure how to. Again, like an afternoon a month, that's a not unreasonable amount of time to take off. And, you know, you would offer a lot of value as a worker beyond just, I never, ever, ever miss an afternoon. And it's just very harsh to say, like, wouldn't this turn off an interviewer knowing that I have like a manageable but chronic health condition? And, you know, that's exactly why we put protections in place, so that people who do have to manage like disability or chronic health issues are not like just shoved to the side and forced out of the workplace. Oh, speaking of the workplace, this next letter is really something. Would you be so good as to read it?
Sure. Subject: My boss goes exploring in my desk. Dear Prudence, I've worked for the same company for many years and love the work, clients, coworkers, everything but my boss. If I take a day off, she often goes through my desk, rifling through the contents and leaving me nasty notes about the things, such as the way I store my pens or why I have a yogurt spoon. She admits that this is not born from any concern about my hiding things, but because she's simply looking for something and then gets distracted and goes on a tear. She's gone through my inbox and outbox and made false assumptions leading to her calling clients or taking action on things that have already been dealt with. Nothing she's ever found has been amiss, illegal, or anything but organized differently than she would want it. We have no HR, but when coworkers have told her that this behavior seems invasive, she maintains that she has every right to do it. We do 360 reviews, and I consistently get outstanding scores from everyone, including her. Do you think this is normal behavior for a boss? What should I do? I'd quit, but I live in a city where jobs are very hard to come by, and there are dozens of applicants for any position like mine. Help.
Wow.
Well, this is not normal behavior.
I was going to say, safely, I feel very confident just answering that question, like, no, this is not at all normal. This is bananas. I am so sorry. I cannot imagine, like, leaving for lunch and coming back to my desk to find a, like, poisonous little note from my boss about how I organize my pens. Like, that is just demented.
And even without the notes, just the fact that she's going through your inbox and outbox and personal items for the sake of it is unprofessional and demeaning on so many different levels.
Yes, yes. And worse than all of that, like, this is all so bad on its own, but she is making mistakes on your behalf at work because she's like half-heartedly going through your inbox, partly reading things, making stupid assumptions, and then jumping the gun and calling clients and creating a mess. Like, this is not just a weird quirk. This is actually affecting your ability to get your job done and your professional reputation. So that's pretty serious. And it's a real shame that you guys don't have an HR department, which I've talked about before, how I feel like HR departments are often very limited in terms of what they can actually do. But this seems like the kind of thing that if an HR department was aware that this was going on, they would be concerned about the company's reputation as well as yours, because this does not make your business look good.
Yeah, and definitely, I think it's important to note that maybe because this letter writer has worked in the same place for many years and they've grown accustomed to this behavior, that they have to ask the question that, is this normal? I think we can both assure you that, no, it's not normal. So don't forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So the letter writer at least does not want their first option to be quitting, which is fine. Although I say put it on the table. I think you should certainly be looking for work elsewhere while you think of other ways that you can deal with this internally. But that's got to be an option, because this just can't go on. Like, eventually she's going to email somebody something that you guys will not be able to fix. You know, like, she's going to send off some half-cocked email and you're going to lose business over it. So what would be your first step? Like, you've already, apparently coworkers have said this, please don't do this. So it sounds like the boss is doing it to more than just the letter writer. It sounds like the letter writer has spoken to her about it because they write that the boss has admitted that it's not that she's worried about the letter writer stealing or anything. She's just always looking for something. So what do you think is the next move?
Well, even if there's no HR department, perhaps there's a company contract or guidelines or a guidebook, depending on the nature of the company, that maybe they could go through and see what rules are most applicable in this type of situation, or how to escalate concerns, or any whistleblower kinds of lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense, because I was doing a little bit of digging after this, because I was kind of unsure, like, is this, you know, legal, because a lot of workplaces, there's not a reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to something like the emails you send from your professional account. But there would be a reasonable expectation of privacy when you're, say, like, changing in the professional, like, in your company's locker room or using the company's restrooms. So it would be worth checking out your company policy, just whether or not there is kind of like any sort of policy around, like, is your desk considered a private space? Like, it would be unusual for a boss to be able to go through your purse. So there's a line somewhere of like what your boss can and cannot reasonably do at the office. And it may be that you guys have a policy. It may be worth checking with your state's Department of Labor to find out like what privacy protections do apply to you. It's weird. I don't normally recommend that people talk to their state's Department of Labor twice in a podcast, much less in the first two episodes. But yeah, it may, frankly, be illegal for your boss to be doing this. It also may very well fall under, you know, the purview of like shit your boss can do when you are at work, which would be a real shame. But it's worth knowing more about this for sure.
Well, I think also the nasty notes might count as harassment. So you want to look into those laws too, perhaps.
Yeah, especially when it's about things like how you organize your pens or why you have a like, that's so irrational to me that I have trouble believing that this boss is not having a lot of trouble elsewhere. So in terms of like escalation, I would say like number one, find out more about whether or not your boss is doing anything illegal. Certainly save the notes and keep a record of the things that she says to you. This is a waste of company time if she's writing you like nasty notes about your yogurt spoon. And this is going to be important when you talk to whoever her boss is. I think it's worth trying to speak to her about it again, just so you can have that to point to when you kind of kick it further up the chain of command, because I think that's going to be the next thing you have to do. Like, you know, just go to her and say, hey, I need to talk to you about what happens when you go through my desk. And stick especially to the stuff of like, you know, you have sometimes misread things in my inbox and emailed clients with mistaken information that I have then had to clean up. That makes us look bad. That's not necessary. And that makes my job harder. Can we both agree that you won't do that without checking in with me first? And if she can't give you that, then that's a pretty clear sign that you need to go above her head. And my guess is she's not going to respond to it well or rationally or reasonably. And at that point, I think you can kind of bring up everything else and say there's a pattern of behavior here that's worrying, invasive, unprofessional, and makes it difficult for me to do my job. And I just think you have to do that, because otherwise she's just going to keep doing this.
Yeah. And I would say that when discussing it, it would be valuable definitely to focus on the workplace and professional aspect of it, because it sounds like general guidelines about privacy and personal space have not really been effective so far. So, you know, I like, Mallory, your script about the company being able to do its job. I think that's a useful one to definitely focus on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can also say to her too, you know, I want to talk to you about what you think is the best use of my time. Unless there's a problem with the way that I organize my desk, unless you can see any ways in which it is affecting my work, I would prefer it if you did not leave me notes commenting on my organizational system or asking why or how I eat the things that I do. That's not related to work. That doesn't fall under your purview. And that's not something that we need to be able to discuss. And these, by the way, are all really reasonable things to say to your boss. This isn't you being like insubordinate or, you know, lashing out or doing something that you shouldn't be doing. Although I am aware that when you have a boss who crosses lines like this, there can be a real sense of anxiety of like, but if I talk back, if I say this is not okay, she might retaliate because she's already doing pretty out there stuff. So I think that's where I hope you trust like management in general at this company. I hope this is just behavior they're not yet aware of, but they need to be made aware of this. And if you fear that they would back her up or have no interest in helping you out, then that would make, I think, looking for other work even more imperative. Especially if it's difficult to find other work in your field, like start now.
Yeah, and maybe a good halfway option would be to look at some freelancing or online jobs, maybe something part-time, so that you can open doors and start meeting new people, maybe going to job fairs. I know that there aren't a lot of positions in the city that she's in, but you know, maybe looking for ones in neighboring cities or neighboring areas.
Yeah, but this is bad. This is just a little bit weird. Like, even if it weren't about emailing clients, like nasty notes about why you have a spoon for yogurt or like the way you store your pens, it's just deeply unsettling, and it like destroys the trust you're supposed to have in your boss's judgment. It makes you feel unsettled at work and wonder like, when's the next note going to come? And can I leave anything in my desk? Is she going to start going through my phone or my wallet? Because she has displayed such bad judgment, it's just sort of like, well, I don't know what to expect from this person anymore. And then you add to that the fact that she calls clients or tries to like repeat actions you've already taken on a project. That's a waste of her time. That's a waste of your time because you have to clean up the mess afterwards. That leaves you constantly worrying, like, is there a client out there right now who has the wrong information because my boss looked at the first two words on an email, flipped out, and then gave them a call? Like, that's It's not just that this isn't normal. This is really bad. This is really bad. This isn't just like, oh, bosses are weird and sometimes they're rude and you have to like put up with a dull story or like a slightly
unsettling.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really bad.
And I'm wondering how much time the boss can spend doing her own responsibilities and supporting her employees if she's going through people's inboxes and outboxes and their desks. So,
right?
You know, this might not be great for her long-term professional development.
Yeah, and she's apparently doing this to a lot of people.
Right.
That's just bananas to me. Yeah, and I, just to say again, like, if you need something from me, please ask me directly. You know, unless you are gone from your desk just like 5 days out of seven, I can't imagine that she needs to be doing this. And this just is stemming from some sort of like free-floating anxiety in her mind that she just needs to scratch a really weird invasive itch. Yeah. Please write us back because I would really like to know how either this boss would respond to any sort of pushback on this or what your boss's boss might say if they were to hear like what she's doing. Because I guarantee you she does not do this to the people above her in management. Like she's not going into her supervisor's office and going through their desk. So this may very well be something they have no idea about. Ugh, man. All right. We are leaving the problems of the workplace. We are sailing into problems of marriage because there are only so many ways for life to be difficult. The subject of this next letter is just romance is gone. Dear Prudence, I'm a 38-year-old married woman with four young kids at home. My 54-year-old spouse, who I've been with for almost 15 years, came out to me and later publicly as a trans woman about a year and a half ago. We've since stayed together. In the past, she had suffered from depression, and she's become a much happier and more loving person since coming out. The issue is that my once strong romantic feelings for her, which I had hoped would regrow after she came out, are virtually gone. I don't want sex or romance with her. She's more like a co-parent and a roommate and a best friend to me now. I've tried, but I'm just not a lesbian. I love her in the sense that I want her to be happy and well, but I'm no longer in love. She keeps saying that she's the same person, just with a different external experience. But for me, she's a fantastic housewife that I don't want to be married to. I've been honest about my feelings and doubts. She's terrified of being twice divorced, and the more I pull back from a lack of passion, the more she tries to please and reassure me. I feel terrible and guilty. What should I do? Oh, I'm so sorry, letter writer. This makes me so sad. It's always so hard when somebody writes in and describes a marriage where two people really care for each other and they both want to do right by each other. And there's an insurmountable issue that has to do with something as big as like sexual orientation. And there's just not an answer that's going to make everybody happy. And I always wish that I could come up with some magic solution. But this sounds really hard for the both of you, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of curious about what they've done to try, because I was definitely up with the letter writer until the fantastic housewife line, and I sensed a little bit of resentment that didn't really seem consistent with the beginning of the letter. And it's understandable because, you know, nobody should be, you know, this is not like an ideal situation for anyone, but it sounds like from what is being described that they're sort of repeating themselves and that maybe it will be beneficial for them to go to therapy or go to a support group. Because it sounds like the cycle is one person is expressing that they're the same and the other person doesn't feel that way and is pulling back. And then the other person is worried because the other person is pulling back. And it sounds like a cycle that's going on. So, you know, of course, I'm going to take the letter writer at their word that they've tried, but I'm just sort of curious of what they've tried and how many ways they've gone about it.
Yeah, I read that line a little bit differently. I think it was more just trying to like put into words this sense of like, she's a great version of a wonderful person that's a woman. And I am not a lesbian. I'm not bi-curious. I'm not bisexual. So like, as cool as those things are, I don't want to be married to a woman. So, you know, when it comes to that, I think the cycle, you know, you can't turn yourself into a lesbian or, you know, or bisexual, no matter how much you want. I think this is a pretty, it seems like a pretty clear cut case of just total sexual orientation incompatibility. And you can try really hard to change your sexual orientation, but that doesn't usually work.
Right.
So I think therapy is a great idea, but I think therapy and separation are probably the only path forward. And of course, you know, it's got to be painful to feel twice divorced. It's got to be hard for her to feel like finally coming out and being able to transition has also, you know, been a precipitating event in the end of your guys' marriage. But it's just, you know, you can't make yourself into a lesbian for just because you want to. And it sounds like you're very clear on you are not interested in women. And that's really sad. But, you know, you shouldn't feel like you have to keep trying to kickstart those feelings. It's been 18 months. You say they have vanished. You try to pull back. And then she tries to please and reassure you, which sounds really painful for the both of you. So I think part of what needs to happen is just that really difficult conversation of, it's not a matter of trying to please and reassure me. I know that you are the same person that I had, like, had children with and love and respect. Of course that's true. But I'm also a heterosexual woman. And to let her know, like, because that's got to feel exhausting for her. Like, maybe if I'm just the best lesbian in the world, my wife will want to stay with me. And that's just not going to work. And so I think it would be helpful to find like a really trans competent therapist, somebody who could like support and affirm both of you as you figure out how to be the best possible co-parents and friends that you can be. And that might not be easy at first, but it's not easy now. But to just make it really clear that that's it. This is not something that you guys can try your way through or fight your way out of. If you feel this confident that you're not even a little bit bisexual or bicurious or gay, and it has been 18 months and she's kind of like killing herself trying to be as loving and attractive and fun to be around and just the best wife in the world, and you're like, you know, it's just not, it's an issue of compatibility. It doesn't matter how great you are. I would like to be with men. The kindest thing for the both of you is to acknowledge what is already the case, which is that the romantic part of your marriage is over. And that's sad and that's hard and that will cause you both grief. But I think it would be worse for the both of you in the long run if you tried to deny that reality.
Yeah, I mean, even though I had a different read initially on the Fantastic Housewife line, I do want to say that these feelings are totally valid and the letter writer shouldn't feel obligated to stay with someone that she doesn't have feelings for. And maybe therapy would be beneficial, if not for patching up the relationships, because like you said, no one can change their orientation, for figuring out how they're going to co-parent or how they're going to, I guess, live with each other's relationship or, you know, lack of relationship in the future, in terms of like, are they going to stay friends? Are they going to have contact? Things like that.
Right. And I hope that they'll be able to find a way towards a future friendship. It's just got to feel so painful right now for the both of them to be thinking, you know, for the letter writer to be thinking, I don't know how to express, you know, my sexual orientation in a way that doesn't hurt my partner, but it's also just, I can't be with a woman. And then for her, you know, soon to be ex-wife, feeling like there's just one more thing I've got to be able to do in order to keep this relationship going. And that's just hard and painful. And this is just one of those situations where you sound like two wonderful people who really care for each other. And unfortunately, your orientations just don't match up. And if I had a better answer, I would give it to you. But I think it will hurt, you know, more in the short term, but less in the long term, to just be really clear right now. And to just remember, it's the kindest thing to do.
And you can do that in a caring way, and you can do it kindly. You know, it sounds like you're pretty sensitive and understanding of the things that your partner has gone through. So, you know, you can continue doing that even as you say that the situation we have right now is not right for me.
Right. And just for the both of you, like, this isn't necessarily something that would be helpful to share right now, but like she deserves to someday be with a woman who is thrilled to get to be with her, who is super into women, who is like, yes, sign me up. Not somebody who feels like, oh, I'm just not gay at all, but I care about you and I don't want to hurt you. Like, again, that's not necessarily something that she'll be able to hear right now. So I don't think that's something that you should say to her, but just she does deserve that. And you know, you deserve the same. You both deserve somebody who really, really wants to be with you. And I hope that you'll be able to get that. I think you will. I'm so glad that you both are like caring, supportive, loving of one another. I think that's a really strong foundation for what's going to be like a slightly rocky road for probably a while, but will eventually get better than it is now.
Right.
So the subject line of this letter is simply not a cruise director. Dear Prudence, my husband acts as though I am supposed to coordinate his life. Well, that sounds familiar. When there is a mountain of laundry to do, he gets upset because I didn't tell him about it. Yesterday, he told me, I'm bored. I want to do something. And I said, what do you want to do? And he said, I don't know. I just don't want to sit around the rest of the night staring at my phone. The next day, he got upset with me because I didn't do anything with him and was on my phone. He had no suggestions for other activities, as usual, and he expects me to come up with things to do. When I have nothing to add, he gets upset and accuses me of making my phone more important than him. If I want to lay on the couch and read the news for an hour once in a while, why is that not okay? I get to choose what to do with my time. I am not his cruise director. I am not responsible for his having a boring night. How do I handle this tonight? When he gets bored and starts being cold to me because I'm lying on the couch and not actively planning what he's going to do next.
So I actually looked at this in two different ways, right? So clearly his behavior is annoying and clearly his behavior is demanding. But I'm wondering if there's a bigger issue that they're not spending quality time. And I'm wondering if they've ever addressed that. And, you know, he's going about it the wrong way. But I'm wondering if what prior conversations they've had about their time together.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you say that because I did, as we were going through this one, obviously the way that he talks about this stuff is horrible and I'm not a fan of it in the least. But it did sound a little bit towards the end, like it's possible that the phone issue is coming up a lot and it may be that there is a legitimate conversation to have around I feel like sometimes we default to being on our phones all night and I don't like that. But then again, the answer to that is I want to do something different. I hope that you'll join me. Let's talk through what we would like out of that. And that's also, you know, yeah, it's not as big a thing as, man, oh, man, if somebody says I'm bored and your response is, what would you like to do? And they say, I don't know. With the sort of like trailing off end of the like implying that like it's your job to think of something, like that's unattractive when children do it. Do you know what I mean? Like that's a classic thing that kids do that's even irritating when somebody who's eight does it. Like famously parents, when their kids say, I'm bored, there's nothing to do. They'll say like, only boring people get bored or like go outside and do something or like, I'm not going to figure that out for you. Part of becoming an adult human being is figuring out what to do when you are faced with boredom or dissatisfaction with a choice that you have made. So your husband is doing something that like everyone hates when an 8-year-old does it. So it's that much worse when a grown man does it. And it sounds like this is kind of a pattern, right? Like when there's a mountain of laundry, he gets upset because you don't tell him about it. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say like, just because you're his wife doesn't mean you have magical laundry radar. I know that it's really hard to get the idea out of some men's heads that women don't actually have magical laundry sensors in their bodies. but the laundry is no more your job than his. You know, you both live in the house. You both use towels. You both wear underwear. You both make laundry. Human beings are laundry producing machines. Laundry is never a surprise because you yourself contribute roughly half. So, you know, the big conversation here needs to be, I think, both about division of labor. Like, hey, my man, If you want to talk about chores or how we handle household management or the relative cleanliness of our house, I'm down for that. Here's what I'm not down for. When you default to the idea that as your wife, it's a little bit more my job to keep the house clean and to remind you of stuff that has to happen in order for a household to run smoothly. That is sexist, it is irritating, and it is a waste of my time. You are just as capable of, as I am, of walking past a hamper, seeing, ah, I am a rational, reasonable adult. I see that the laundry hamper is full. I know that we have a washing machine. I'm familiar with the fact that if you put soap and clothes and water in the washing machine and then turn a button, it washes the clothes. So I don't require a grown woman saying something like, hey, there's laundry, because I know what context clues are and I remember things that I've done in the past. Don't say that to him with quite so much sarcasm and venom in your voice as I just did, because you two are married and you should speak a little more kindly to each other. But yeah, that's like a pretty important deal.
Yeah, and I'm kind of wondering what their pattern was before. Was it always like this? What is their division of labor like? What is he doing? Does he need you to tell him everything?
Yeah, it's like, I need a dishwasher warning. Like, I walked past the dishwasher today and there was a light beeping and I was so frightened and horrified that I threw myself into a ditch. Like, you don't need warnings about chores, my guy. Like, you are a grown man and you know how laundry works. And so if there's a lot of laundry to be done, just do some laundry. That's not something that you need to be reminded of. Yeah, and I think it's never great when you're at a place where both of you are a little bit contemptuous of one another. So, like, he says, I'm bored, and you say, like, you know, well, what do you want to do? And he says, I don't know, I just know I don't want to do this. And you guys just sort of, like, sit on different ends of the couch in contempt. Like, that doesn't sound delightful. But yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, like, come back to your husband. Don't wait for him to do it again and just say, like, hey, I love you. I enjoy spending time with you. Sometimes I really enjoy checking the news on my phone for an hour. I don't want to, like, spend every night of my life just glued to my phone on the couch. But I'm really comfortable with doing that every once in a while. So occasionally when you get bored and you just have a sense of, I don't know what I want to do tonight, but I do know I don't want to look at my phone. When you bring that to me in the sense of I'm bored, fix it, that puts me in, like, a parental role in terms of you. And I'm not into that. That's not going to work for me. If you are bored but don't know what you want to do, spend a little time thinking about what you want to do. It could be with me. It could be by yourself. It could be with somebody else. You're a resourceful adult with a lot of options. Think about those things. Actively plan your evening if you feel like a quiet evening, like, you know, catching up on social media and then making supper is not something you're interested in. But don't just, like, walk into a room and announce you're bored with this look on your face that's like, obviously you're going to handle that, right? You're the laundry and boredom, like, monster.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there is nothing wrong with the letter writer wanting some time to themselves and, you know, being on the couch and reading the news. So, you know, I'm not sure how explicitly the letter writer stated it, but, you know, it's okay to set that boundary of, well, right now I want to do this. I want to spend some time by myself. I want to read the news. Maybe we can do something tomorrow.
Yeah, or I'm a little skeptical that he only seems to bring up, like, the problem of phone addiction when he's bored and his wife wants to, like, just chill out on the couch for a little bit. Like,
yeah,
maybe that's true. Maybe that's genuinely an issue in your marriage. I'm just a little skeptical that he's like, but I'm bored now. You know what? We're all on our phones too much. Whatever happened to the good old days when people went outside and shook hands with eagles and danced on mountains and what have you? Like, I think this has more to do with he is experiencing a vague sense of dissatisfaction, unease, and anxiety that comes with boredom. And he wants to make that totally your problem. And I think the redirect that needs to happen here is that you can say, like, hey, I love you. I do care about you. And, you know, I don't want you to be bored, you know, five nights out of seven. But, like, I would rather you say something like, hey, I'm feeling kind of antsy. I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to go to a bar and meet some friends for a drink, or I want to go see a movie, or I'm going to just take a walk around the block and think through what sounds good to me to do next. You know, do that. Then I can kind of talk to you about that as a fellow adult, and we can decide whether or not we want to do something together or spend a little time apart. Nothing wrong with spending time apart, even if you're in a relationship.
Yeah.
But put a little thought into it. You know, tap into your own resources before you attempt to get me to fix your problem. Like, if I don't know why you're bored and I don't know what you want to do. And when you try to make me guess, I feel, you know, put upon and resentful. And I don't want to do that. And we're not always going to be bored at the same time. Sometimes you're going to be like, oh, my phone, I'm so sick of it. And I'm going to be like, really like looking at this phone, having a great time talking to my friends all over the world and catching up on emails that are important to me.
Yeah, and quality time is one thing, right? So it's nice for couples to spend time together. But I think the dynamic here is that this letter writer is starting to feel responsible, or like the partner is making her feel responsible for something that she doesn't really feel necessary to manage, which is understandable, right?
Yeah, it is so relatable if somebody says to you, like, oh, I'm kind of bored and frustrated with myself, and I think sometimes I default to being on my phone instead of thinking through things that I would rather be doing, and I just pick sort of like the easier option, the path of least resistance, and then that does not result in long-term happiness, and I want to kind of reevaluate my approach to that, and I need to get out of the house tonight. Like, man, oh man, can you meet that person halfway? Is that a totally reasonable and appropriate thing to say to your partner? But he's not doing that. He's saying things like, why is this laundry here? I'm shocked by the fact that we own pants. I'm bored. Why is that your fault? Put your phone away. I put mine away. And that's just like, it's not a super responsible or mature or loving approach. And I think it is good and necessary for you to lovingly correct him.
Yeah, I guess I was just wondering when I read that he said, I don't know, I just don't want to sit around the rest of the night staring at my phone, what the response was. You know, did the letter writer tell her husband, okay, so I'm not going to be responsible for this, and sort of set the boundaries and the parameters, because it sounds like this has been cycling for a long time. So, you know, it sounds like some honest communication would be good.
Right. And I think, too, it's important to think through, like, the letter writer said, he said he didn't want to spend the rest of the night staring at his phone. The letter writer said, I want to look at my phone for an hour. So I'm not sure what the expectations here are. I don't know if either the letter writer is a little bit downplaying what they were doing, or a little bit, you know, overplaying what the husband was doing, or if the husband was really kind of exaggerating out of a sense of frustration. Neither one of them sounds thrilled with the way that things are right now. And it's absolutely true that you're not his cruise director. So just go ahead and like feel real free about not suggesting him, offering him suggestions on what he can do. But definitely talk about this when you guys are not frustrated with one another, and like, you know, try to figure out how you can both approach it better. And then for you to be able to set those super appropriate limits of just like, my man, I do not have an internal sense of like the laundry meter. Nobody does that. We all just use our human eyes to look at the laundry and categorize how many socks are there.
Well, maybe some planning would also be helpful, right? Like maybe if they divide the chores, like you talked about before, having a conversation about division of labor, and maybe they have designated date nights, but the other nights, you know what? Sorry, friend, you're on your own and I'm doing my own thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all different couples come up with different strategies for what does and doesn't work. I don't know what's going to work for you guys, but I can tell you right now what's not going to work is him just constantly thinking like, you're the laundry woman. Tell me when there's laundry. That's a bad strategy. No one should do that.
Right. Agreed.
Justine, thank you so much for helping me alternately mourn with those who mourn, comfort those who need comforting, yell at those who need to get yelled at but can't really hear us and probably don't listen to the show. You were a true stalwart companion on this road to wholeness.
Oh, thanks. I hope that the advice was good.
Even if it wasn't, we're both going to be dead soon enough.
True.
So it won't really matter all that much. But before we die, I would love it if you would come back on the show sometime so that you could give us more advice.
I would love to come back on the show.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. Have a fabulous rest of the day. And, you know, be sure to do your laundry when and if the pile gets to be too much.
Yep, will do.
In fairness, my entire island and my kitchen is covered with clean laundry right now. So I am, you know, just as guilty as the husband in the last letter. Although I have not called anyone in my own life and said, why didn't you tell me I owned clothes?
Well, you said it's clean, right?
It is clean.
They have a mountain of laundry to do, so already you're a step ahead.
Oh, yeah. Suck it, last letter writer's husband. I'm better than you, at least for today. All right, Justine, thanks again.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops. Thanks for listening.